From the Sky News Centre at 5, an American woman kidnapped as a schoolgirl has met her mother again for the first time in almost two decades. JC Lee DeGarde was 11 when she was allegedly abducted by Philip Garrido, a known paedophile. His claim JC was kept in tents and sheds and now has two children. Neighbours aren't surprised at the news.
I always had the heebie-jeebies about the guy, and you could tell, like, his back house, the windows were boarded up and there was, like, bars over the windows.
I don't know, I just thought he was a weirdo. Never knew that he had children back there, though. None of that.
The 22-year-old man is starting a 14-year-old jail term for sexually assaulting two young schoolgirls. Monsieur Ali lured the 13-year-old into his car in Greater Manchester and plied them with alcohol. One of their mothers, whose voice we've disguised, says they were naive to accept the lift.
They didn't have them type of thoughts in their head. They didn't realise in a few minutes' time what would be happening to them. Otherwise, if they'd have known that, would never have got in the car.
The pensioner who poisoned his estranged wife has been given a 350-day suspended prison sentence. 69-year-old William Dowling from Lancashire poured mercury into his wife Maureen's tea. He hoped that by looking after her and nursing her back to health, he would win her back. A body's been found close to where a teenage boy was swept out to sea. The identity has not been released, but it's feared it could be Shady Reed, who was washed away by a wave in the Porthcawl Bay area of South Wales last week. Arsenal striker Eduardo is facing a two-match ban after being charged by European football's governing body over an alleged diving incident. UEFA has accused him of deceiving the referee. A court in the Netherlands has told a 13-year-old girl she cannot attempt to sail solo round the world. Judges say Laura Dekker would face mental and physical risks if she were allowed to go ahead with a two-year trip. Britain's Mike Perrin's just done the same voyage, aged 17. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Keenan.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton, John Keeley. Our old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories and talking to John about some of his work as a city councillor. We'll also be asking why a medieval fresh water supply into Bristol city centre has stopped working for the first time in 700 years. Marina Morris has a report on the nuclear industry and has been out on the streets of Bristol talking to you about what you think of the nuclear business. We'll also be finding out if the last swimming pool in Bridgewater really is being closed down this weekend and what locals down there have been doing to try and stop it. But before all that, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, average is around about 15 degrees Celsius. That's during the daytime. Cloud cover and rain. We have sunny spells on Saturday. Cloudier, though, on Sunday, with some gusty wind, too, on Sunday. Next week, 16 degrees Celsius, roughly. And during the week, sunny spells on Tuesday and Friday. A fair amount of rain on Wednesday through till Thursday morning. And next weekend, after the bank holiday, this is not the bank holiday weekend, 5th and 6th of September, that is. Again, those temperatures are slowly creeping down, aren't they? This time down to 15 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be cloudy and rainy and windy. And Sunday, though, relatively sunny. So this weekend coming this weekend. We're just starting now. The better weather is on Saturday. Next weekend, it looks like the better weather will be on Sunday. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next 2 weeks from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and I'm joined by John Keeley, who's Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton. Hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
So, what did you do before you became a councillor, and how long have you been a councillor?
A bit of a strange journey, really, because I was a councillor here for 20 years, and then a couple of years ago, sadly, lost my seat. So, for a couple of years, I wasn't on the council. So, for most of my adult life, I've actually been a Bristol City councillor. I've had a variety of jobs, but currently I work in the health service at the French Inn Hospital.
Okay, and what committees are you on?
I'm on what's called the Overview and Scrutiny Management Committee. That's the main committee that the council have. I'm vice chair of that, and essentially all the other council commissions, if you like, scrutiny commissions, all put their programmes to that commission. If there are any call-ins, if members of the public or other parties want to call in any decision that the council has made, the cabinet has made, that they're not happy with or think they should have a look at again, it comes to the committee that I'm on, and then we actually look at, discuss the issue with them, with the people who are concerned about it, and then look at what remedies there might be.
Well, I'm surprised that you're on a committee like that, because I would have thought, the thing is, it's the Liberal Democrats are ruling Bristol, so why is another Liberal Democrat involved in the committee that scrutinises that? Surely it's better to have the Conservative, Labour and Green on the scrutiny side.
Well, there aren't enough councillors, in a sense. It's the same problem with Parliament, really. It's the same argument there, where you've got the executive running the country, in this instance, the Labour Party, and they're drawing the executive, actually, from their general membership. So nobody's really holding Parliament to account, essentially, because you're all in the same party, you've got a majority. And it's, in a sense, it's not the most ideal system. I don't like the system we have at the moment. I've never liked it, but unfortunately we've had it in place now for about 10 years. Because of it, we have to work with it. So, the Liberal Democrats have the largest number of councillors on the City Council. A number of the scrutiny chairs on the council that are in opposition hands, and I think that's important. When Labour ran the council with a majority when I was on there in the past, they took all the cabinet places and they took all the scrutiny chair positions as well. So it's very, very difficult to hold them to account. Under Liberal Democrat administration, we have a proportional approach where a number of the chairs are held by the other parties, and I think that's healthy for democracy.
But aren't the Liberal Democrats, what is it that singles out, do you think, the Liberal Democrat Party, particularly in the city here? What's the ideology? Because for many people, they see the Liberal Democrats as just Tory light.
I don't know why they would see that. If you look at where the Liberal Democrats in Bristol actually represent, we represent not only, the leafy suburbs and the west of the city, but we represent Easton here in the inner city. We represent Southmead and Lawrence Weston area. So we represent every community. And I think that's the uniqueness of the Liberal Democrats in Bristol, which, the other two parties are class-based. That's the big problem. New Labour essentially was a modern Conservative Party. It was bolted on the top of the old Labour Party, and David Cameron's now trying to do the trick in reverse. But essentially, they are class-based parties, and I think the Liberal Democrats, the Liberals, as we were in the old days, were classless in that sense, or tried to be.
Well, with the Tories and the Labour Party going more classless, surely there's nothing really much to separate you out anymore.
Well, I don't know. I think really with the Tory Party, it's just a respray. I think it's a PR Cameron respray, pretending that they aren't class based. If you've seen some of the things that have been coming out in the last few weeks, from the Conservatives about charging people for services, about the expenses and them not being paid enough, wanting to be paid double if they're going to do away with their expenses. When very many people in this country are just relieved to have a job at the moment. There's a huge amount of unreality, in the Conservative Party. And all the spin of David Cameron, the nice smiles and all the rest of it, can't hide the fact that they are still a party, that believes in big business, actually, and wealthy people. And unfortunately, the Labour Party have actually lost their ways over the last 10 years or so. Tony Blair took them, into the centre ground and much more to the right wing of both us and the Tory Party, by the looks of it. And some people thought Gordon Brown might take them back more to the centre or a little bit more to the left, but unfortunately, he doesn't seem to have a clue of what he wants to do. So I think it's been left to us. I think the people of Bristol have responded to that, and that's why the Liberal Democrats are running Bristol, because we actually appeal to the widest group of people in the city, and we're standing up for the kinds of causes that they believe in, the environment, social justice, and internationalism. These are all things that people, particularly in Bristol, talk about a lot. And, you know, we have the council leadership, we have the mayor of Bristol, and we have an MP in the city. You know, I think that's excellent. We're very delighted the people have put their trust in us.
So why was it that, I think it was 2 years ago or so now, that there was a vote of no confidence in you for the home care privatisation programme? I mean, you know, the Liberal Democrats don't really sell themselves as a party of privatisation, do they?
Well, we weren't actually privatising home care. What we were doing was modernising it. I mean, the home care service was still going to exist after the proposals. I mean, these proposals are on the table still. And the fact is that the council has not actually grappled with the fact that we've got an ageing population, that the service we have at the moment is very traditional, it's very expensive. Bristol, I don't know if people don't really realise this, but Bristol pays more for its home care than any other city in the United Kingdom. And yet, even though we're paying more as taxpayers, we provide less home care. And I think that is a disgrace. I would like to see us provide more home care to the vulnerable in this city, and we could do it if we actually just changed the way we worked. Every other city has done it under Labour, Conservative, Liberal, Democrat, but oh no, not in Bristol. We've got to have second-rate services under our opponents, whether it be in education, whether it be in home care, whether it be in anything else. Liberal Democrats have actually said, you know, if you vote for us, we will challenge and try and change some of these things. And home care, over the last 2 years, because we haven't run the council, over 130,000 hours of home care for those 2 years could have been provided to vulnerable people living at home, some of them actually in discomfort, and we haven't. We fail those people, and I think that's a shame, and I hope we will try and put some of it right. But we're not privatising the home care service.
So how are you changing? How are you going to change things? Because now the Liberals are in the driving seat.
Well, obviously we're going to be doing quite a lot of things. As you know, our main thing has obviously been education.
I'm still talking about home care.
Oh, home care.
I mean, the elderly home care. You were just now saying that, you know, things have got to change. So how are they going to change now?
Well,
what fixes do you see?
Well, I think the thing is, I mean, obviously I haven't been on the council for 2 years, and over the last 2 years there's actually been a select committee looking at home care. I mean, select committees should be time limited. It should have been for about 6 months, but they've continued it. That select committee has now ended, and a report is going to the cabinet, and cabinet will then actually have a look at what the options are in terms of what the recommendations have come from, you know, the home care select committee, and then that will go to council. What those proposals are going to be at the moment, I do not know. I don't know. But obviously there has to be some change, you know, to make sure that the service is modernised.
So you were just about to start talking about Liberal proposals for education. Can you say something about that before we introduce Martin?
Well, all I'll say is that, you know, we've seen over this week actually the big changes that have happened in terms of, like, you know, the education results have actually improved quite significantly. And I think in this building is a, you know, I don't know if your listeners know, but this building obviously is actually, you know, on the City Academy site. I mean, you know, the old St George's School wasn't actually providing a good enough education to our young people in the inner city. And I think one thing you have to say is that, you know, we must do more, particularly those in more disadvantaged backgrounds within the city, to give them a better educational start. Because with that educational start, it gives them the choices, the life choices that in the past they were denied.
But why isn't an academy school intrinsically better than another school? Surely it's just to do with the way the school is
well, organized. I don't think they are better. I think you know, the Liberal Democrat Party policy is actually that there should be good schools in every community. You know, I don't actually think that academies, I think they're a bit of a diversion, and they're also privatising education, which I worry about, and bringing in business. But having said that, you know, at the end of the day, most people who send their children here would choose this against what was happening before. But I think we could have actually probably improved the education if we'd actually all worked together anyway, personally.
OK, John, you've had a fair go there. Now we'll have a little chat to Martin. Martin Summers is joining us. Tell us about, you're an old Labour economics expert and our pundit we have on here every week. Martin, tell us about the work you were doing at Bristol Debt Advice Centre.
Well, I was actually a researcher at Bristol Debt Advice Centre, looking into, you know, questions around how people get into debt and what needs to be done to improve the situation, particularly around collection of council tax.
So what sort of proposals did you come up with? I mean, I know these haven't actually been implemented, but can you just give us an idea of your strategy?
Well, I mean,
your strategy for dealing with the credit crunch?
Obviously all debt advice agencies, and including Citizens Advice Bureau, are being inundated with people with debt problems. There's always been people struggling with debt, especially lower income people. But of course, this is now getting worse. The council tax is a rather unfair regressive tax, as I'm sure John will agree, and probably it needs to be changed. But at the moment, what you've got is that the people who can't pay their council tax or having difficulties paying their council tax, that's an absolutely accurate snapshot of the most vulnerable people in the community who need help and support. They are generally the working poor, because of course people on benefits don't pay council tax. So they are what we need to do really is develop a system where people who can't pay their council tax are picked up quickly by the council and other agencies and given help before they get into real trouble with debt.
Okay, so
we've got to be proactive rather than just waiting for people to turn up on the doorstep when they're in terrible mess.
Before we dive into the week's news, John, what are your thoughts on that particular point?
Well, I can't disagree with anything that's been said there. I mean, one of the big things that I'm finding in my caseworkload actually in Eastern Ward is actually a huge rise in the amount of people who are struggling with what are enormous bills. And every tax system has to be based on people's ability to pay that tax, and the council tax is not based on that. Liberal Democrats would abolish it and have local income tax. I'm having big debates with the leadership within the council group, looking at how we can support people who are struggling to pay the council tax at the moment, and trying to get the help into them, early, as opposed to thinking, we've got a crisis now, let's start sending the bailiffs into people, which I would be very much opposed to. So we need to look at a range of things. But people are now going to struggle, and really we must, as a parliament must now look again at the taxation system and make it fairer, or actually improve the benefit system, or take more people out of the tax system altogether, which I think Liberal Democrats want to do, is take about 4 million people out of the tax system altogether on lower incomes, so they're not actually they're not struggling with these bills. Enormous tax burden in this country.
So that's something that parliament can do, but what do you think, there's a scope for us to do something here in Bristol as well?
Well, really, the only thing we can do is offer really good debt advice, good support for people who are struggling with their bills, make easier ways for them to pay their bills and that kind of thing. There's not really much. I mean, obviously, these taxes are actually set up by Parliament. They're not local. They're national. This is another thing, which is this country is far too centralised. But, the taxes, the government expects you to collect the taxes. If the taxes aren't collected, then the services aren't provided, and there are obviously going to be problems there. There are ways that people can be helped. There is actually good debt advice out there, money advice within the council and within, debt advice services within the city. Do seek it out. Don't just hide your head under the pillow and expect it to go away, because your problems will just get worse.
One of the things that happened this year for the first time was when council tax bills went out this year, there was a leaflet in there giving all of the debt advice that was available in the city, both directly from the council and from other and the voluntary sector. I think the problem is that there's such a potential demand out there. Mm. And I would argue in a general way that debt advice is not the sort of thing you need to be cutting in a major recession stroke depression. It's absolutely essential that people have access to it.
Well, that's something we can all agree on, I'm sure. Now let's go and have a look at some of this week's stories. We're starting off with Boris Johnson here. Now, city outrage over crackers tax plan. Boris is leading an attack on the financial watchdog, because earlier on in the week they came out and said that some of what the banks are doing is not socially useful and that there should be some kind of tax, a windfall tax or something, on the banks. John, you want to start on that one? What do you think about what Boris has to say?
Well, I don't actually agree with Boris. I think the banks in the system have brought this country to its knees. I mean, the fact that we've got about a trillion pounds worth of debt, £350 billion worth of taxpayers' money being lent to these institutions, you still seem to be paying themselves bonuses, by the way. I was outraged to hear that the Royal Bank of Scotland had hospitality boxes at Wimbledon. I really think really humble boxes would have been more appropriate than hospitality boxes. And essentially, we've got to tackle this problem. I mean, from my perspective, from two angles. The first angle really has to be that we should strip out these casino bankers, if you like, from the general bankers, and rather
boring, mundane banking about giving people loans and mortgages and all the rest of it, which is what most people expect high street banks and building societies to be doing. You know, that should be stripped out and dealt with separately. And these other people, if they are going to get in all these hedge funds and all the rest of it, then they need to be regulated a lot more. And I think Europe has a big role to play here, actually, as well, in terms of making sure that they're regulated. And I think the French and the Germans are really beginning to tackle this. When, you know, Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown, you know, probably because they're frightened, their fingerprints are all over this disaster, have actually sort of been very, very laggardly in actually coming forward. So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is I would start taxing all these bonuses. You know, when you talk about people, you know, earlier about council tax and people not being able to pay, I think it's outrageous when you've got people like, you know, Fred Goodwin and those earning millions have made, millions and millions of pounds and being paid bonuses, and they're still expecting their bonuses, because there was stories on the news this week where people were saying, oh, they're going to ruin the City of London and it'll go abroad and risk if we're not paid all this money, or if we can't get involved in this casino kind of banking system. And they still seem to be thinking it can be business as usual. Well, I don't mind if the banks want to keep paying these people the bonuses, but I think tax them to the hilt on these bonuses and actually kill them off, because that is the other thing that is actually destroying, you know, the whole culture in the banking system, and that has actually led to the problem where we've had these loans that were given to people, these toxic loans, which now cannot be repaid. And I think the whole thing really actually needs really dramatic action. And okay, I have so to say, they haven't actually done it. They, you know, the government haven't actually done it. For all Gordon's Iron Chancellor, I mean, he's been pretty rusty.
So if you or Vince Cable were in charge, what would you be doing then?
Well, Vince Cable has actually said most of these things. I mean, essentially, it was Vince Cable who alerted everybody to the fact that there was £1 trillion worth of debt, you know, personal debt in this country already, with the highest debt in the whole Western world. He was saying that he was laughed at in Parliament. Oh, you know, Liberals don't know what they're talking about, as usual. You know, they're actually economically kind of like, you know, illiterate. And it turns out, actually, he was spot on, and they should have listened to him and done something about tackling the indebtedness of society. But we are where we are. But the other thing that Vince has said and the Liberal Democrats are saying is that we need bankers to get back to lending to businesses and to individuals, and having, you know, sensible arrangements in terms of the equity and the ratios of the loans they're lending out to people. And all this casino stuff, I think somebody should be having a royal commission into it, into what it is these people are adding to British society, because all they seem to be is just legalised gambling, you know, and we've all paid a very heavy price for it. People in Woolworths and in other industries have lost their jobs over it, and other people on short time working, and other people looking over their shoulder at the moment, and these people are to blame for the situation that the world's in at the moment.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this story? Because Boris Johnson comes across as quite an affable chap, and now he's thrown his lot in with the bankers, saying actually they should be able to earn what they want, and any tax on the on these banks would be bad for the country, and mean that all the bankers would catch a plane or get on a boat and go abroad.
Well, I think that the original suggestion by Adair Turner, as the head of the FSA, that there should be a Tobin tax. This is blue skies thinking, and this is what
can
the
you just explain what a Tobin tax is?
A Tobin tax is a tax on transactions, especially short term transactions. So if you're making a long term investment in something, you have to pay a small percentage. But if you're making lots and lots of small, you're churning. Basically, you have to pay every time you churn. I mean, it's been put forward by development agencies as a potential way to fund development in the third world. If you've got a financial Tobin tax, it's named after an economist called Tobin. But it strikes me as very strange that there's a head of the FSA who's basically a civil servant, and the FSA, of course, is actually a financed by the financial industry itself. It's not actually a government body.
So how can we have a regulator in the banking industry which is financed by the banks themselves?
It blows my mind to imagine. I didn't realise this until I met somebody from the FSA when I was at a meeting, and they said, "Oh no, we're actually a trade body. We're not actually funded by the government at all."
So they're sort of lobbying group for the banks.
Yeah, well, I think what we've got here is regulatory capture. That is to say that the institutions that are supposed to be regulating are actually captured by, I mean, people like Adair Turner used to be bankers before they became regulators. No doubt he'll go back to being one when he stopped being a regulator. I mean, I think we've got to start, I mean, I agree with virtually everything John said. We've got to raise taxes if we're going to rebuild the public finances. But I'd also think that going forward, whoever wins the next election, I think it would be disastrous to cut public expenditure for the sake of it in the middle of a recession.
Okay, before we leave,
we learned all of that in the 30s, and we're about to relearn it if we're not careful.
Before we move on to the next story, John, can we just have your last word on that? What do you think? What do you think? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything. Obviously, it's been said here. I mean, obviously,
public spending, should it be going up in order to get things moving in the economy?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, as somebody who joined what was the Liberal Party, I mean, Keynesian economics is actually very well known, as a form of economics. What did Keynes do? He said spend money, to actually, give people work in a recession, which at the time seemed, quite revolutionary. So Liberals have always said these things. Vince Cable and Nick Clegg are both saying exactly the same thing. It would be a disaster in the middle of a recession to cut public expenditure. I don't know any serious political party that is proposing to do that at all, so I can't.
I think the Tories are. I mean, they're basically saying we can't afford public expenditure because we've given all the money to the banks. I mean, we shouldn't perhaps have given the money to the banks is another issue, but I mean, I can't. What will happen if whoever comes to power cuts public expenditure, in my view, is we'll get into a Japanese deflationary spiral. And I think the public at large need to be educated about this. It sort of fits into that people's household expenditures. They think, oh right, we've got a hard time, everybody's got to tighten their belts. But if everybody tightens their belts, the economy crashes. BA pilots, for example, have voted wage cuts for themselves. If everybody cuts their own wages, then there's no demand in the economy. This is basic stuff.
I really want to move on to the next story, but Martin, what is a Japanese deflationary spiral, please?
Well, the danger of any situation like this is that there's not enough spending in the economy, and then the economy deteriorates, so there's even less spending, and you go down and down. Now, I'm not saying that you can just spend your way out of recession, because there's more issues involved than that. I mean, the British bond market, British debt, people won't buy British debt if you do have too much public expenditure, too much of a deficit. But nevertheless, what will happen, as we saw in the 1980s, if the government cuts expenditure during a recession, is the recession gets worse, and eventually you just have to stop. So let's not go down that road, and I think even if the Conservatives win the election, they're going to have to think very hard about whether that's a good idea or not.
OK, well, now moving on to Afghanistan, we're going to have a brief look at this story. The Taliban have denied the Kandahar bombing. There was a massive bomb exploded in the Afghan city of Kandahar that left at least 43 people dead, 65 injured too. And the Taliban have immediately said this is nothing to do with us. Now, can we believe them? John, what do you think?
Well, I don't know if we can believe them or not. Obviously, there's never an easy way of actually being able to verify things. But certainly, the timing would suggest, obviously, that somebody was trying to destabilize the political process that was taking place in Afghanistan.
Well, this is after the elections, anyway.
Right, yeah, of course it was. But the elections aren't over because, you're prejudging whether there's going to be a second runoff or not.
Possibly.
Yeah, so, I mean, if there's going to be a second runoff, then no, the elections aren't over.
The bomb was also placed apparently very close to a mosque at a wedding time. Is this the sort of thing, Martin, you think? What's going on here?
It's virtually impossible for us sitting in a radio studio in Bristol to know what happened there. That you've got all sorts of people fishing in troubled waters in Afghanistan. The Taliban say they didn't do it, but who's the Taliban? We don't know, really. I don't think we can really comment on this. Obviously, it's awful. What I would comment on is that in the whole of Helmand province, where the British forces have been active, there were only 150 people who turned up to vote. And that's virtually one British soldier dead for every voter. And I think that many people in Britain are going to ask themselves the question, I mean, what are we trying to do here? The population of the area where we're fighting doesn't actually support our presence.
OK, before we go on to the local stories, the final one, and this hasn't been really commented much in the British mainstream press, 10,000 Israelis are urging a boycott of IKEA and Volvo. Now, this is a story to do with a story which appeared in a Swedish newspaper, the Aftonbladet, on August the 17th. And the story actually says that the Israelis have apparently, Israeli doctors and Israeli Defence Force, have returned bodies to people in Palestine with organs missing. Now, apparently and I've seen actually on the internet some photographic evidence of this, and the Israelis are saying that there's actually now a major international row brewing over it. Now, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, because you haven't actually seen anything about this in the British press, although it does seem as if there's a sort of diplomatic incident over it.
Well, I mean, obviously, according to the story that we have in front of us, it hasn't been verified. There's no actual proof to show that this has actually taken place.
Well, the argument is that autopsies have been conducted on these Palestinians, and even when the cause of death is very obvious, that they've been shot.
But the person who actually who's produced the article actually hasn't been able to verify whether or not anyway. But having said that, I must say that I find it incredibly rich, you know, that you know Israelis want to boycott goods from you know from Sweden. Which is a very peace-loving country, actually, and they don't seem to want to boycott goods from their own country when they virtually bombed Lebanon to a standstill, you know, causing tens of thousands of deaths and £3 billion worth of damage to a country that was already actually trying to recover from a civil war. And then leading on from that, they've gone to a country essentially that, you know, has a police force against, you know, virtually... you know, a major military power in Palestine, you know, in the Palestinian state, and of course, you know, huge amounts of deaths and injury there, and you know, left people homeless. And they don't seem to be terribly bothered about boycotting their own goods. I mean, I certainly would say to anybody listening to this program, boycott anything you can to do with Israel until Israel actually sees sense. If they want to be treated like a Western democracy and show, you know, that they act in a mature way, then it's about time they sat around the table with people in Palestine and not take their organs, if that is the case here, but actually work with them to make the Palestinian state a viable state and to give those people some hope and some respect, as opposed to the rather depressing and disgraceful scenes of bombing you know, UN compounds and all the rest of it that we've seen, which we do not expect from a country, you know, which you know, purports to be, you know, a Western style democracy. And so I think the Israelis should be boycotting their own wine and their own oranges and anything else they produce, alongside me, who is actually doing that at the moment in my own little way.
And Martin, what are your thoughts on this? You had a chance to read through the story now.
Well, I think specific allegations have got to be properly sourced. I mean, it's all very well. I'd need to read the article in the Swedish newspaper to see whether it's properly sourced. But I virtually agree with everything that John says. I don't think there's any dispute about the fact that the Israelis is blatantly in breach of international law in many respects. What does worry me about the peace process that Obama is suggesting is that on the basis of a six-month voluntary freeze on further settlements, he will then put sanctions on Iran to prevent them developing their nuclear industry. And I know we're going to be discussing nuclear power later in the programme, but that's very bizarre, because basically the Israelis are being told that they, as long as they put a brake on their illegal activities, Iran's perfectly legal nuclear programme will lead to sanctions on Iran. I mean, this is just a looking glass reality. It's completely topsy turvy, and we're all going along with this as if this is a reasonable proposal by Obama. The British government is going along with it. I don't think that we should be going around threatening. I mean, the Iranians are members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They are entitled to have a nuclear power program, and we're going to discuss whether we should have one later on. But there's absolutely, the Israelis have got a nuclear power program and nuclear weapons and are non-signatories of the NPT. They are the ones who are threatening everybody with nuclear Armageddon in the Middle East. What about sanctions on them?
Okay, so John, what's happened apparently is the Swedish government have completely distanced themselves from this, saying this is just something for the Swedish press. The other thing is, I've just been flicking through there to see that this Swedish journalist is not saying that this has taken place. He's simply reporting what the Palestinians are telling him. He doesn't take a view on it one way or the other. So what are your thoughts about the relationship between the Swedish government and the freedom of the press over in Sweden?
Well, I must say I'm absolutely delighted that the Swedish government have decided not to actually, you know, get involved. It's very, very easy, you know, to, you know, for your own national interest to try and actually, you know, neuter your own press and keep it quiet when it's not convenient for your own national interest. And obviously the Swedish government have weighed up the situation and realised that maybe, you know, it may cause it some damage commercially in Israel, but it thinks actually freedom of press is a much more important ideal to hold. And as I said, it would be a shame. It's a shame that the Israelis themselves don't hold truth, you know, in such high regard as the Swedish government have done here. And what the Swedish government are saying about their press is absolutely correct. You know, they are entitled to make their opinions known. They're entitled to discuss, debate things, and to report on them. And you know, maybe somebody should be looking in to see if there is actually any credence in these stories, and if these, you know, the Israelis, instead of actually saying there isn't any, they've got no proof either way. If people are saying they're getting their loved ones returned to them and their organs missing, there are questions to be asked, aren't there?
Okay, right, well, let's move on to looking at some of the more local news, and we're going to start now with a because Marina Morris is here with a report on the nuclear disaster in Chernobyl, and after Marina's reported, we're going to have a listen to what people in Bristol have got to say about what they think about the nuclear power stations around here, because Bristol Channel area is one of the most busy nuclear places in the world. We've got three nuclear power stations. Anyway, Marina, welcome to the studio.
Hello.
And can you just give us your report on the Chernobyl disaster, please?
Yes, today I'm remembering Ukraine's experience of nuclear power at Chernobyl. The people of Ukraine are very understandably concerned about the safety of nuclear power. As the world looks for carbon-free methods of generating electricity to slow the effects of climate change on the planet, interest in expanding the nuclear power option is increasing across the globe. But the world remembers the Chernobyl tragedy in Ukraine, which demonstrates the risk of nuclear power. Safety standards in nuclear power stations across the world changed after this incident. But is that enough? The Chernobyl disaster is considered to be the worst nuclear power plant disaster in history and the only level 7 instance of the international nuclear event scale. The UK's highest level events on this scale was the Windscale fire level 5 in 1957, which released substantial amounts of radioactive material into the surrounding environment. The accident of on 26th of April 1986 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant named Lenin in Ukraine, which was then part of the Soviet Union, resulted in a severe release of radioactivity following a massive explosion which destroyed the reactor. Most deaths from the accident were attributed to radiation. The explosion and the resulting fire sent a cloud of highly radioactive fallout into the atmosphere and over an extensive geographical area. Many of the firefighters who initially fought the explosion and prevented further explosion that would have devastated Eastern Europe died a slow and painful death within a few years of the incident, but are viewed as heroes who prevented a much greater release of radioactive materials. The radioactive cloud drifted over extensive part of the Western Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and Northern Europe, this light nuclear rain falling as far as Ireland. Large areas in Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia were badly contaminated, resulting in the evacuation and resettlement of over 336,000 people. According to official post-Soviet data, about 60% of the radioactive fallout landed in Belarus. There are vast inconsistencies in the published death tolls from this disaster, but the human cost is far wider than even this. Radiation exposure can result in sterility or affect DNA. There have been reports of significant birth defects in Belarus, which the World Health Organization attributes to better reporting rather than the effects of radiation. Following Chernobyl, the people of Italy, in a referendum, decided to ban nuclear power generation. The Italian government has plans to start building new power plants within the next 5 years from now. We can understand the advantages of clean, dependable power generation, but are we taking full account of the true costs and hidden risks to society and future generation? Here are some vox pop of Bristol people's opinion about the nuclear power station.
Okay, Marina, we're going to come back to that in a minute. Let's get into talking about this issue now whilst I sort that vox pop out, which we'll hear in a minute. John, what are your thoughts initially on this idea that what we're having is, I'm afraid, we're having lots of changes going on in the nuclear industry around here. The government does look like it's going to be building, particularly at the Oldbury site and the Hinkley site. And whilst we hear that the contracts or these things will only be advanced as of next year, apparently activities are already starting at the site at Hinkley and also at Oldbury. What are your thoughts on nuclear power and whether it's appropriate at the moment?
Well, my thoughts are, I mean, the Liberal Democrats as a party are opposed to any nuclear power plant program building at all, and that happens to be, that accords very nicely with my own view, that you know, this technology is very, very dangerous. It's very, very expensive. It only will actually account for a very small part of the UK's energy needs. Everybody seems to think, you know, build a few nuclear power stations and we have 100%, you know, electricity generation, but it actually isn't true. And of course, then you're left with very dangerous waste. And what was said about, you know, very importantly about Chernobyl and you know, the other accidents that we've had, you know, within the nuclear industry. I mean, you know, you can't turn the clock back on these things. I mean, you know, there are, you know, towns, you know, now are completely empty for thousands of years because they are contaminated. And you know, this is a very, very dangerous, you know, form of electricity generation. It seems to me kind of very bizarre as well when we're here on our doorstep. We have you know, a very clean form of energy generation, which would provide about 5% of the needs of the whole country, and that obviously being the Severn estuary itself and the barrage, which you know, if handled in the right way and looking at the environmental concerns and taking, you know, some of those into consideration, we could still have very clean energy providing a lot of the needs of this country without, you know, without going down the nuclear power route.
Okay, well, before we hear what Martin's views on the subject, let's I've managed to get hold of our what the people of Bristol, what you think, and let's have a listen to now some opinions from the streets of Bristol.
I am very concerned about the future, the waste material from those power stations, which has to be disposed of and has a very long-term shelf life. And that concerns me, the build-up of that in the world. I don't know, my feeling is it's not a good thing. But I'm in the hands of the experts at the moment, some of whom say that this is the cleanest form of fuel. Personally, I'm not convinced. I'd like to see more emphasis placed on the better use of energy and the less waste of energy, conservation of energy, and better equipment and better ways of using things rather than produce more and more and more energy and let it go to waste.
There are issues, but I think it's worth thinking through. But I think broadly, I would say I think it's a good idea. Plenty of risk, plenty of danger. I think it could be, at least it could be better than the current alternative.
If it's a controlled development, I don't have any disagreement with it. It's definitely a risk, but it's not a new risk. It's a risk that's been understood for many, many years. The risk is more about the management and the maintenance and the long-term program for recycling the waste, etc., etc. But actually, as a risk, it's an understood risk, and it's a balance of whether or not that risk is within your national risk appetites for the generation of electricity. In an ideal world, you wouldn't want any nuclear power stations.
I think on balance I'm in favour of it. It's the least worst option of the options that are currently available to us. It's the most practical one, anyway, because of sun, wind, you know, certainly in this part of the world, it's so unpredictable, you cannot guarantee a steady supply, whereas with a nuclear power, you know, it's there all the time. Obviously, there are concerns to be addressed, but I think as long as they're properly managed, and it depends on the type of nuclear reactor you're talking about. You know, some nuclear reactor designs are inherently more dangerous than others.
It's about having that balanced discussion between the risk of nuclear and the risk of other impacts from climate change.
Nuclear power, I think there's enough natural resources we could harness instead, like solar power and hydroelectric power. I would say no.
I think it has its upsides. But there's also the fact of, you know, getting rid of the waste after, you know, it's depleted the uranium or whatever. So on the upshot, it's, you know, it's clean, it's relatively safe, but there's also the downside. So overall, I'd probably say no. I'm not, you know, I'm not happy with any more nuclear power plants.
I think it's a modern alternative power. It can be dangerous. We've already seen how it can work, how it can, what can happen with it. In Russia, what happened a few years ago.
I think that would be a good thing in terms of eradicating fossil fuels and trying not to use coal-fired sort of power stations. So hopefully be more environmentally friendly long-term. However, there's obviously the downside or danger, I suppose, with any nuclear-based fuel source that it could go wrong. I think it's a good alternative. Yeah, overall, I think it's a good alternative. It could work well because I think France have got the vast majority of their fuel source from nuclear power. So I think that's quite a sort of safe way, yeah, proceeding.
So I'm all for it. That's the nuclear power with the windmills going round. Go ahead with it and see what happens.
Okay, Martin. So we hear there a very, very mixed response. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, one of the most important...
Sorry.
One of the most important things that was said in those responses was we need to use energy more efficiently. And I think that that is the key to resolving a lot of the problems. We're very wasteful of energy, and that's why we need to have, or we think we need to have, all of these solutions, because we're just wasting energy hand over fist. The thing about nuclear power as well, from an economic point of view, is that it doesn't pay. The private sector on its own would never develop nuclear power stations, because if they were made to cover the insurance costs of dealing with the waste, they wouldn't be able to do so. So when there were attempts to privatise the nuclear industry when the Conservatives were in power, the City of London took one look at the books and said, no way. So what people have got to realise is that it doesn't actually pay its way. So it's actually, in that sense, an inefficient source of energy.
But I mean, what, with all this talk of climate change, isn't this really the least worst option?
Well, as I said earlier, the thing about if we want to deal with climate change and carbon emissions, we need to actually deal with carbon emissions, not say, hey, we want to have the same lifestyle we've had before and use up all of this energy and just plug, just botch on at the end another source of energy. We need to change our lifestyle so that we are less energy wasteful. And we can retrofit everything from light bulbs to, this is a kind of technology that already exists. The Rocky Mountain Institute in the US has done studies on this. Physicist Amory Lovins has looked into the dynamics of this, and the solution to a lot of our problems is to make sure that all of our daily equipment is absolutely efficient, and of course a lot of it isn't.
John, is the talk of, because we had a really good report there from Marina about the Chernobyl, but isn't that really scaremongering? These incidents are almost like a once-in-a-lifetime or more than that kind of thing.
Yeah, but when they are a once-in-a-lifetime, look at the devastation they cause. I mean, you know, you've got... I went to a display down in Millennium Square a few years back. It's now a book where this photographer took loads of fantastic, stunning photographs around the world of, you know, some very famous landmarks like Ayers Rock and other things. But the most poignant one for me was he went to Chernobyl, and there's a city in there which has got nobody living in it and probably will never have anybody living in it again. Could you imagine, we've got three on our doorstep, Albury, Barclay and Hinckley. Could you imagine if there was an accident there, or on one of the trains, by the way, it comes down Stapleton Road with their waste? It means that Bristol would be completely, cut off, isolated. It would be emptied. You know, we're not a very big country. So, yes, some of the accidents, you're right, there haven't been as many accidents. But, you know, if there is an accident, it will be very, very major and very devastating to a very small and overpopulated country like ours. And what do you do with the waste? I mean, people say it could last for a thousand years. So we're leaving a legacy for people in the future. When really, it's partly our own selfishness that we think just by having nuclear, we can go on actually consuming exactly the same way as we've done in the past, when by actually putting in triple glazing, putting in better, insulation with our homes, demanding houses. I mean, our house builders get away with murder in this country. You know, going back to Sweden, we ought to look at what the Swedes do in terms of insulating their properties and the amount of heat that it retains and all the rest of it, and look at that more. Once we've actually cracked that and done our energy efficiency properly, looked at the alternatives like wind, wave and hydro and all the rest of it, they're not going to obviously resolve all the issues. Then let's have a debate about what happens with the future, but we're not even scratching the surface yet on what we should be doing. We could do a lot more with the technologies we've got already, without going down this route, which, you know, is very expensive. We'll not actually, address our energy needs anyway.
Okay, we've got a pretty resounding no from the studio, although very much mixed messages from the public. Okay, we'll move on to the next story, which is again another Bristol one. The police have been urged to crack down on Eastern gang culture. Now, this is very much your patch, John, and in fact it's come from the other city councillor, I think Farouk Chowdhury, in Eastern. So, and I discovered this on a relatively new news website on the internet called Bristol247.com, which is run by an ex-Evening Post journalist, and Bristol247.com. Tell me what you think about this, John. I mean, why is it that your competition, if you want, has come up with this proposal rather than you?
Well, I think the difference between me and the competition, if you like, is that I've actually dealt with this as casework and actually gone and met the residents and worked with the police, community support officers, to ensure that the people who are being affected by some of this...
We had a story on here a few weeks ago, which was about the Somali newspaper, Somali Voice, there was some sort of arson attack on their offices. And there was a talk at the time from the police that this was possibly related to this whole gang culture in Easton.
Yeah, I think the difficulty that I have really is that when people talk about Easton, quite a lot of Easton as a district is actually in Lawrence Hill ward, and so the Lawrence Hill council is really, you know, this their patch, not ours. I mean, Fruit Chowdhury probably doesn't realise or know this, but Galter Street actually isn't in Easton ward. If he was the local councillor, he knew his patch well, he would know that. And the one who stabbed people on the cycle track, that isn't anything to do with gang culture at all. And the police actually cordoned off Brixton Road, which again is in Easton Road, off opposite, you know, is in Lawrence Hill ward. As I said, I wouldn't expect him to know all that, because it's essentially him just putting out a press release without really checking into it in any detail. The part but he's linked a load of things in together and made it sound like gang culture, where two of the things he's mentioning are not gang, or one of the things you mentioned, there's no suggestion they are gang culture. The one about Chelsea Road, I think, is about, you know, young people, and it could be gang culture in a sense, but there isn't a huge amount of evidence. I mean, I walk the streets of Easton virtually every day in my part of the ward. I don't go to Lawrence Hill ward as much, because obviously I'm busy in my own patch, and people are concerned about antisocial behaviour. They are concerned about, you know, about youngsters roaming the streets and, you know, people feeling menaced, and so we need to do something about it. I have to say to Fruit Chowdhury and to the Labour Party, they've been in office for 11 years. Why have we got this culture? Why haven't they actually dealt with it, you know, in that time? You know, tough on the crime, crime and tough on the causes of crime. They've actually failed the people. The police have had lots of money, have had lots of resources. It's all this time, it's all this bureaucracy, and they, you know, we need them right in the streets. Having said that, I have to say that the police, I've come back having been away for 2 years, and the support I've had from the police so far, I cannot fault. I've phoned them, they've gone round and met the people who have been affected by this directly, and have tried to support them. It's easy to put a press release out, but you have to actually do the thing to go with the press release, which is the action as well. And I'm afraid to say, Fruit hasn't actually, from what I can see of it, actually done that.
So you're saying that there isn't the problem with gang culture? It seems to me you may be trying to score a few political points here.
No, I think it's the other way around. I think the political points have been scored, if you like, actually by the press release. I mean, most of it actually isn't in Eastern Ward. What I'm saying is there is an issue to do with, you know, people feeling unsafe, and to do with antisocial behaviour. But to actually make a giant leap into saying, you know, gang culture like they have in London and Manchester, where they have drive-by shootings in Moss Side and places, is not the same, I'm afraid. We do not have that same thing there. So, no, I don't agree with it.
OK, Martin, what are your thoughts? So you live in Stapleton Road area, don't you? So yep. What are your thoughts about this one?
Well, I don't think there's a... I want to make party political points about this. We all want a safer city. And most of the time in Easton I feel safe, but of course occasionally, you know, if you have a bad experience, and I have had bad experiences, you start to worry. What is worrying is a whole generation are leaving school this summer and there is no work down for them. And this is the root of gang culture. If we don't give people jobs and opportunities and chances in life, then we're going to see an explosion of this. And this is what's really worrying. If we're thinking of mass unemployment that could go on for decades, that's what we're looking at, then we're going to have a destruction of the quality of life, because young people who are denied opportunities become dangerous both to themselves and to the rest of the community. And everybody from every political party and across the spectrum needs to be focusing their minds on this devastating issue of youth unemployment.
Okay, our final story this week is the Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, which has hit the national news some of the national papers. People are saying that this place out near Fayland, I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to pronounce it, it's a zoo, and where they have boards on the side of the zoo which talk about the possibility of creationism, and the Humanist Society are calling for all any kind of sort of government support, licenses for the zoo and things like that, funding to go, and for the tourist authorities not to promote this place. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Do you think that's a good idea or not?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I mean, if they're in receipt of public funding, then perhaps there is a case that they ought to be presenting, you know, what is essentially the scientific view of evolution.
I don't think that's what they're saying. I think they're not in receipt of the tourist authorities, which are in receipt of public funding, are distributing their leaflets.
Well, I mean, you can't stop people believing silly things. If they want to believe silly things and they want to pursue things which aren't true, then I don't think people should be taught creationism in schools. That's taxpayers' money being used. But if people want to set up a zoo to propagate their ideas about creationism, as long as they're not in receipt of public funds and they're not bothering anybody, they're entitled to do what they want to do, aren't they? Even if they're wrong.
John?
Well, one of the best thing out of this story for me really is the fact that the Humanist Society seems to have all of a sudden the last year or so come much more on the radar, and I'm pleased to see, you know, that kind of challenge being in the system, which appeared to have been missing in the past. I think this is a bit of a silly season story, to be honest with you. I mean, my own son's actually been to Noah's Ark Zoo, and he hasn't come back believing in creationism or anything else. He just had a lovely day out with a load of furry animals, and I think essentially that's just what the owners of the zoo are actually saying. I think the council are actually agreeing with them there, so I think it's a little bit of a storm in a teacup on one level, I think the zoo has actually given a reasonable account of what it does do, and I know people have been to Noah's Ark and really enjoyed it. So I don't think, you know, in the end it is actually about brainwashing people, to be honest. And I do agree that, you know, we need to be much more vigilant about these creative, you know, type academies that we're setting up, under which Tony Blair with his sort of religious zeal started, in this country, and that is taxpayers' money being used. And I think that is of concern to me, and I should be getting a very close eye on that kind of thing.
Okay. Thanks for looking at these stories, but we've got a particular new news story, if you want. I've been looking into St John's Conduit, which is a water supply in the city centre. For 700 years, St John's Conduit has been bringing fresh water into Bristol city centre from a spring at the top of Park Street. Built by monks in medieval times, and carefully looked after by the church and city council over the centuries, the water pipes start near the spring, which is just in front of the Boston Tea Party at the top of Park Street. They run under Culver Court, Frogmore Street, Pipe Lane, finishing up at a somewhat neglected-looking water spout by St John's Church at the junction of Broad Street and Nelson Street. So what is a conduit? Well, it's a tunnel that runs not far under the street level, which allows access to maintain and repair a water pipe, which was originally made from lead or wood. In Exeter city centre, for a modest sum, you can actually take a tour through the old conduits from Easter through to October. You may think that modern water systems that we have now means there's no need for the pipe, but as many elderly Bristolians will testify, for long periods during the Second World War, it was literally the only supply of fresh water still working in Bristol city centre. People queued up outside St John's Church after Nazi bombing had destroyed conventional supplies. So, while Hitler's bombers, by the hand of Providence, did not stop the flow of fresh water, something closer to home has. Anyway, the city centre sewage works in Trenchard Street, which Wessex Water completed at the beginning of 2009, seemed the obvious cause, so I called them up in an attempt to solve the mystery. Wessex Water say they're aware of the problem because a lady member of the public called in to tell them, and they have themselves investigated by talking to the project manager for the sewage works, Mark Thomas, and site manager, Patrick Shannon. It seems there's a valve under the Queen's Shillings pub on Culver Street, which Wessex had to shut off to make sure that there were no leaks at the beginning of the works in 2007. When the works were completed early this year, the valve was opened up again, but nothing happened. No water was flowing through the pipes further up the system. All Patrick Shannon could suggest was that somebody else had turned the water off somewhere in between Culver Street and the top of Park Street. Now, the main problem seems to be identifying whose responsibility these old conduits are. So if anybody knows anything or can suggest further lines of inquiry, do please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. And I hope to bring you further reports on that little mystery in the next few weeks. So coming up, it's the Sky News at 6. But that's all we have time for this week. Join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM 93.2. where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you have stories you want discussed, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, John Keeley, Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton, and our resident pundit and old Labour economist, Martin Summers. Our reporter was Marina Morris on Chernobyl. You can listen to previous week's shows and find out what's going on to be on next week by visiting the BCFM website, bcfm.org.uk, and going to my presenter's page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you another relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land, so whilst it might seem sometimes there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because the soulless corporations and the super rich have taken much more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out fairly with modern technology, not controlled by a rich elite. We can all live quite happily together. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.